This is Dixie Noonan. I'm with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I am at the New York Avenue offices of the Federal Reserve in Washington, D.C., with my colleagues Ron Borzakowski and Sarah Knaus. We are here with Jim Michaels and Dave Caperton of the Federal Reserve Board. Jim, if you could tell us your job history at the Federal Reserve, how long you've been here and in what capacity?
26 years, 1 month. And that's about it. I was going to get the weeks and days, I suppose. I came to the Fed in March of 84, and I joined the General Counsel's Office in the litigation section. And I remained there until May of 1995, and then came over here for the opportunity to work on the consumer side and work in the consumer regulations branch of the division, where we had about a dozen lawyers. And I've been here ever since, and I joined as a senior attorney because obviously I had some seniority over the legal division. Then I became a manager in, I think, July of 1998, and then I was given an officer's position in, I think, January of 2003. So I'm an assistant director of the division.
Great, thank you. I just want to start out by showing you this document. It's FCIC 110396. It is titled The Problem of Predatory Lending, and it's dated December 5th, 2000. Are you the author of this document?
Yes, I am.
And why did you draft this document?
And Dave told me about this document last night, so I went back and refreshed my recollection a little bit.
Good.
I looked through the document. It appears to me that what this document is, and I was kind of surprised by the date, but I think I know why it has that date. This document is what I would have prepared for myself as my talking points in making a presentation to our Consumer Oversight Committee in a meeting we would have had in, I believe, probably November or so of that year to discuss with our Oversight Committee governors proposed regulations that we were considering, we were in the midst of drafting, and bringing to them for their sort of concurrence, advice, guidance, as a regulatory proposal that we published for public comment under the Truth in Lending Act.
When you say the Consumer Oversight Committee, is that the committee of the Board of Governors?
It's a committee. You know, the board has a number of committees, and we have an Oversight Committee for Consumer Affairs. So yeah, that's the committee.
Do you know who would have made up that committee at this time?
At that particular time, it would have been Ned Gramlich and Larry Meyer.
Do you remember the substance of? Well, first of all, let me ask. You said that the date confused you.
Well, because I know the meeting. We had a public board meeting. This was a regulatory proposal. We did put it out for comment. So I know we had a public board meeting on this regulatory proposal in December, about December 13th of that year. And so normally we would not brief the committee so late for a document that has to be circulated and drafted and redrafted so close to a board meeting. So I do know the committee meeting we had was in November, not December.
So perhaps this got updated?
Well, and I know probably what happened is, I looked at this and I said December. What probably happens is people ask you, can I have a copy of your presentation? It's a nice summary of what we're working on. And probably I redated it because I reprinted it out. I might have made some, you know, when you're doing it for a presentation, there's all kinds of typos. I might have cleaned it up a little and changed some typos around or something. And I'd probably put a new date on it when I reprinted it.
So what was being considered? What did you present to the board here, since you've had the chance to refresh your recollection?
To the committee.
I mean, to the committee.
To the committee.
Thank you.
Well, we were, and we'd had a series of public hearings, actually, and there had been a congressional hearing. We were proposing rules that we thought would strengthen the protections provided by HOPA, which is the Home Ownership Equity Protection Act, which is part of Truth in Lending. After a series of discussions with our Oversight Committee governors and, you know, internal considerations, we decided to come up with a package of things we thought made sense as a regulatory proposal. And we did publish it for comment in December.
So if you go to page 10, there's a proposal concerning unaffordable loans.
Mm-hmm.
And it says the the proposed, what I consider to be the proposal, which is this first paragraph. Uh-huh. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, what I can't remember exactly is whether at that time we were in a discussion stage or whether we actually had draft Federal Register as draft documents. I really don't recall that. But obviously this was intended to have this discussion with the governors, whether or not we had drafted rules that way or had not drafted them yet. This was intended to evoke a discussion with them about whether or not this was something they wanted us to pursue.
So the first paragraph says, creditors may not engage in a pattern or practice of making HOPA loans based on the collateral without regard to the consumer's ability to make the scheduled payments. And then right under that, it says this proposed rule would expand the current HOPA rule and deem the practice of making unaffordable loans unfair for non-HOPA loans as well.
Yes, that was that's what we were putting on the table was our proposal for them to consider whether we should go forward with that.
Mm-hmm. And then what was the outcome of that discussion?
After the discussion by the committee and the staff at the meeting, the guidance from the governors was that they didn't want us to pursue that.
Do you remember why?
I don't remember the exact discussion. I know that we did talk about it for a while, and I think one of the questions was, you know, were we dealing with something which was currently an issue in the market? In other words, were we trying to address the problems that we actually saw in the market? And so what made this a little bit different from other things is this wasn't aimed at the really high-cost market where we were dealing with predatory practices. This was really aimed much more broadly, and I think there was some discussion about whether it was appropriate to do that. And you know, the key question I think that this raises is we refer to it as asset-based lending. And what HOPA is designed to do originally was to get at strictly asset-based loans in this really high-cost sector of the market. And what this would have done is really spatially banned asset-based lending in the mortgage market completely. And I think the discussion focused on whether it was appropriate at that time to just ban asset-based lending in the mortgage market completely on the entire marketplace, or whether that wasn't something we had a problem with, if that wasn't something we saw as a current issue or current problem, why were we going that far? Why were we doing that?
Were there any concerns raised about the Fed's legal authority to go that far?
You know what? I'd have to think about that. I'm not sure. I don't specifically recall that. I mean, part of this is we have lawyers here, the general counsel's office lawyers. I know the general counsel's office lawyers were at the meeting. I wouldn't have raised that. I don't think we, as the lawyers in this division, would have put this on the table for discussion if we felt it was legally untenable. We're not going to put forward stuff. You know, we can't do this, but here's a good idea for you. So I think inherently I must have, and frankly, my boss must have thought this was legally tenable. Whether the general counsel's office thought so, I don't know. I don't recall.
Would the proposal have banned no documentation loans?
You know, it's funny because when I looked at this last night, it's not clear it would have. And the reason I say this is because further on in the document, we draw the distinction between what we thought we were doing for HOPA loans and what this would have done for non-HOPA. And it's an interesting distinction, actually. We did ultimately strengthen this rule for HOPA loans. HOPA, when enacted in 94, and even under our original rules, said you don't make these kinds of asset-based loans. You have to have income or assets to support the regular payment stream on the loan, not just collateral. And we strengthened that rule in this rulemaking. And we said, look, the way you do that is you have to verify and document. Now, what's interesting about HOPA, which a lot of people don't focus on, it doesn't deal with these problems on a loan-by-loan basis. It has this pattern and practice requirement. And that's something we didn't feel we could get around legally. HOPA says you don't engage in that business as a pattern of practice. It doesn't mean an individual loan couldn't be based on that. And so we said, okay, so the corollary to that is as a pattern and practice, you have to document and verify income. If you don't do that as a pattern of practice, then you have a pattern of practice of not considering. Okay. What I noticed is there's a distinction between that and what I seem to have wrote up here about the rule that would be broader for the whole market. We don't seem to be discussing having that document and verify rule for the market as a whole. It says to prove they considered repayment ability, they might, and then it has a list of things they might do. So it seems to me that was, at least at the time, we seem to be considering that a slightly different version of the rule. That you might have a, if you're talking about no doc loan is not verifying income, I think that's pretty much what people are talking about, not verifying. This suggests that even if you don't verify income, there would be other ways to consider repaying on the ability other than strictly through verifying income. And it might be their payment history on other loans, the balance in the deposits. So it suggests that there might be other things other than verifying income that would get you over that hurdle in the non-HOPO environment.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I am telling you basically what I sort of looked at last night. I didn't have any independent recollection of that. This actually surprised me when I saw it. So,
who was there any discussion about this proposed rule about who would have enforced this in the broader market?
Well, all of Truth in Lending and all of HOPA in terms of enforcement is the same. I mean, under the Truth in Lending Act, including HOPA, enforcement is spread among the agencies who have supervisory responsibility for those particular institutions. The Federal Reserve has responsibility for issuing the Truth in Lending regulations, including the HOPA rules. But the enforcement in the statute has always been the same, which is that if it's a national bank, it's up to the OCC to make sure they're complying with all the laws, including TILA and HOPA.
What about an independent mortgage company?
Federal Trade Commission. And over the years, they brought a number of HOPA actions against mortgage lenders. I can't think of the names off the top of my head. One of them was a local company and the associates. I mean, you know, bringing HOPA cases against independents, that's been their responsibility, and they've done it.
So there, the argument that if we could pass this rule, but no one would be there to enforce it, that's not an argument that would really make any sense.
Well, if you're asking me today whether I think it would make sense to say we're not going to enact a HOPA rule because there's no one whose job it is to enforce it, no, I wouldn't. We didn't have that discussion at the time, but no, it wouldn't make any sense. In fact, the state attorney general said they're really to enforce HOPA as well.
If you turn to the next page, page 12, it says, it's titled Prohibiting Specific Acts and Practices That Are Unfair or Deceptive.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like this lists additional practices. Would this have also applied to all mortgages?
Yes. We were really here. This meeting was talking about what we would propose as additional HOPA rules. So, yeah, it says authority under HOPA to prohibit, yeah.
Right. So, but as I understand it, the authority under HOPA can extend to all mortgages.
Right.
And so that's what this would have applied to all mortgages. It would have, for example, eliminated deceptive ads and misrepresenting loan terms and getting signatures on blank documents so consumers don't see the actual terms.
Right.
That was, and so what happened with this proposal?
Well, it's interesting because I have a very clear recollection of this. As often happens at our oversight committee meetings, and Ron probably knows this, is you have a very a very broad agenda, and you have an ambitious hope of getting through everything. And what happens is the economists, the lawyers, and the governors, they get so heated in their discussions and debates, you run out of time. And governor's time is precious around here. A governor has given you 2 hours out of their schedule, and you've taken it. You've taken up a lot of their day. We ran out of time, and we got to the end of the meeting, and I recall we didn't have time to discuss this, but we made a specific conscious effort to say this will stay on the table. We'll have further meetings about this because it was controversial. I think that there was some recognition at the table. This was a controversial part of what we were going to discuss, and there was just no more time, and so we deferred conversation on that.
Was there a conversation later that happened before the public meeting?
Yeah, I recall there was a lot of back and forth, and I would say non-meeting discussions. I know that there were phone calls between my boss and Governor Gramlich. There were probably phone calls, I'm now speculating here a little bit, about between her and the legal division. There were probably a lot of internal conversations.
Who was your boss?
Adrian Hurd. There were internal discussions, and I think that with a lot of these little discussions, there was a consensus building that there were reasons why this wasn't going to fly, this wasn't going to go forward.
And what were the reasons?
Well, there were a couple of interesting points being made, and one of which was, if you look at this list of things, and you'd say, you know, these are things that are legal. There is nowhere where it's legal to have deceptive ads or misrepresent. These are a list of things that truly are already illegal. And so by having this rule in place, you really weren't prohibiting acts that weren't already prohibited. So now the question is, by having a regulation tell people, okay, don't deceive, don't misrepresent, exceeding the word misrepresent here over and over, don't use fraud, okay, are you really having any effect? Someone says, you know, the problem with fraud and misrepresentation is the people who do it don't know it's prohibited. What you need is one more rule telling them not to do it, and that'll cure the problem. The perception was that these rules would not have prohibited anything. That wasn't arbitrated and probably wouldn't change behavior. What they would have done would create a different legal redress system for those acts. Because under HOPA, consumers have a cause of action for HOPA violations, which is sort of a civil action under Truth in Lending. It's a private remedy. And then there's a statutory construct for what damages they can get. And it's essentially, you can get actual damages, and the statutory damages are everything you've paid on the loan, essentially. So it's a very expensive remedy. So the question was whether or not, you know, adding a private cause of action with a HOPA remedy really was what we should be about, or whether we're actually having any effect on the market. You know, there are other ways to get at these things. One of them is the Federal Trade Commission Act. One of them is common law, state law. The question was is whether or not we needed to add one more remedy as part of the toolbox, or whether or not we just weren't going to have any effect.
Was there the feeling that the Board of Governors wouldn't support? I'm going to talk about both the unaffordable loan provision and the prohibiting specific acts.
No, I don't remember that discussion. I know with this one in particular, the question was, I think what was raised with us is, look, you know, maybe some of these things are things you could do, but the Federal Trade Commission Act might be the better way to go with this rather than HOPA, for example. That the Federal Trade Commission is structured differently. There is no private cause of action, but there is government enforcement. And so rather than say, okay, you know, go explore your Federal Trade Commission Act authority, the problem with that is that we can only use our rules-making authority for that for banks. So you wouldn't get the whole rest of the mortgage market. You'd be telling banks, well, don't engage in misrepresentations and fraud, and going, is that really where the problem? You're really getting at what you want to get out with doing that. So that didn't go forward. So on the other part of your question, did we say the board won't go for this? No. I mean, we're sitting with Governor Granblatt and Governor Meyer, two very bright, thoughtful economists. And we have other bright, thoughtful economists in the room, because the Fed's full of that. And you know, there was a perception that this wasn't the right way to go in terms of policy on the mortgage market. I don't think there's ever sort of a, okay, well, who's going to vote for it? I've been at a lot of committee meetings. I don't think we've ever had a discussion about who's voting for what and who's supporting it. We make decisions based on the merits of the discussion of the things.
Were you involved in the July 2008 rule changes?
Yes.
So at that point in time, the Federal Reserve did, in fact, adopt regulations that applied to the entire mortgage market.
Not exactly. It depends on whether you mean all players in the market or all mortgage loans.
As I understand it, there's at least a false advertising one that applies to the entire mortgage market.
So our final rules from July 2008 are adopted under HOPA and Truth in Lending.
Okay.
So those rules apply to all mortgage lenders, all people who are in the mortgage market. And you're right, the advertising rules are broad. They go to mortgage advertising, not just high-cost mortgage advertising. The unaffordable lending ability-to-pay type rule, which you call it, only applies to subprime, the high-cost, we call high-priced mortgage loans, not high-cost HOPA trigger, but high-priced above the construct we created for a sort of a threshold.
So which is the same as the HMDA? You adopted the same as the HMDA.
It is. We adopted the same threshold for what's sort of a proxy for a subprime.
So if I am who I am, because I actually don't fully appreciate this, so I'll just act as myself and not as some independent person. The HOPA loans, the rule is something like 8% above the Treasury rate for asset of this maturity, right? Something like
there's
that.
There's a points and fees trigger and there's a rate trigger.
Right.
The rate trigger, after we reset that trigger in 2000 because we have statutory authority within a very narrow range, and we put it down as low as we can put it under the statute.
Which is 8%.
8% over the Treasury rate for
comparable
maturities, which is interesting in itself because you look at the loan 30-year, because it's a 30-year loan, and you say, well, they don't price them that way, they price them on the 10, is that right?
Right.
We're stuck with the statute. So.
So, but then, if you compare the HOPA rate trigger, I'm going to ignore the points and fees trigger for this moment, if you don't mind. If you compare the HOPA rate trigger to the July 2008 higher-priced mortgage loan under HOPA trigger, mm-hmm. which I think is something like 1.5% above something else.
We don't use Treasury. HOPA, the HOPA statute uses Treasury and looks at the APR on the loan, how far above Treasury you are.
Mm-hmm.
And for this, for what we did, we used average, we call the average prime offer rate. We said, what are loans being made out in the mortgage market? What is the average prime rate for prime mortgage customers? And we said, and if you're paying 150 basis points above that, then you're in
the category.
Higher priced category, yeah.
So, sort of a moving target then.
Mm-hmm.
Because the prime rate changes.
Oh, well, markets move. I mean, the question is, it's not whether you're paying more than X, it's how much more are you paying than the average customer with, you know, good credit.
Right. So if we get back to sort of this world that I'm trying to describe, we have the HOPA trigger, rate trigger, and we have the July 2008 separate HOPA trigger.
Well,
which one's higher? I mean...
Oh, that's clear which one's higher. But the HOPA statute deals with really high-cost loans. So in today's world, if you have Treasury about 3.75, somewhere around there, 3.75, let's just say, and you add 8, 8 and 3 is 11.75. Okay, so, and if you have points on this loan in addition, it's going to be higher than that, but just dealing with rate. I'm talking about the high-cost HOPA trigger, it's over 11% in today's market. And subprime would be, let's say, 5.5, somewhere around 6.5, 6.75. So it's clear which one's higher.
So it gets at a much more significant part of the market.
The HOPA statute was intended to deal with not just subprime lending. It really is focused. The HOPA statute, first of all, the HOPA statute doesn't really, to me, focus on subprime. It focuses on predatory lending. It focuses on loans that people were concerned were being made that were designed to fail. When you're charging 11% to somebody, you know, you have to question, are they on a loan they can afford? I mean, what's the purpose of this loan? Is this really a loan designed to fail? What's up with this? So there's a whole series of protections that apply to those loans separately from every other loan.
So the July 2008 rules apply to subprime broadly.
Right.
That's the idea.
Right.
Why wasn't that done before?
Why didn't we adopt the July 2008 rules when? In 2007, 6,
any
5,
time
4,
between
3, 2?
2001 and 2008? And was it ever considered before the period in time leading up to July 2008 when we know it was considered?
You're expressing me to give you my opinion today? Or you want me to give
you
my mindset back then?
I'm asking if you were involved in any discussions here at any point between 2001 when the rules were adopted and when the Fed started considering adopting those rules that became enacted in July 2008, whether there were discussions similar to what you proposed.
Was this the last chance? Was this the last discussion of it between then and...
Yes.
I think that when discussions began on this again would have been when we saw changes in the marketplace. I think that after we adopted these, there was some period of time between, and these were finalized in December 01 and went into effect in October 02. So I think, you know, from then, from 01, 02 period, until we really started to see, there were things going on in the marketplace that were new developments. There seemed to be, you know, concerns were raised, and I can't, my memory isn't this good, but somewhere in, I don't know if it was late 2006, or whether we're talking early 2000, somewhere in there, there started to be alarm bells sounding about, you know, lax underwriting, that somehow, you know, subprime loans are being made, you know, under different standards, under different procedures than had historically been the case. And part of that is the default rates, and I think the early payment default, they call them. The question is, what's going on here? What is suddenly, why are we seeing these trends in the data that are different? And then we started to have hearings, and we started to examine this, and people started to study it. And the answer is, well, we're seeing different underwriting standards. We're seeing this originate-to-distribute model. We're seeing a lot of capital in the secondary market, you know, pushing for investments. We're seeing this growth in the stated income lending. You start to see these changes. Well, something's going on here. This isn't a good trend. And then you start to say, well, what are we going to do? And so you start to see, we started off... we actually started giving guidance on one of the first things that started happening is you saw the growth of what we call non-traditional mortgage products. And that was one of the early things we saw, and we addressed that quickly and said, well, you know, these products, there's a lot of red flags with these products people should be more careful with. So we issued a statement on subprime, on the non-traditional mortgage products.
That was on the safety and soundness side, though, right? That would only have applied to banks under the Fed's regulatory purview.
Not Feds. That was an interagency action, actually. That was done by all the bank agencies. That would apply to all the depository institutions.
But it wouldn't apply to sort of these independent mortgage lenders.
That's correct. Although, you know, the comment letters, I think we were getting, I'd have to go back and look, but we published that stuff for comment. I think we probably got comment from a much broader section of the industry, knowing that if we do that, that taints, you know, these products everywhere. And obviously, I think a lot of people think that has a huge spillover effect, because once you've tainted that product in the market, then the investors get worried, and then, you know, investors, who's going to offer it? So, I'm not the expert. I have to study that. But anyhow, we started with that, and then as these problems started to become more apparent in terms of what was going on in the broader market with products other than those, then they started to say, well, we're going to have hearings and figure out what to do next. And I think it was early 2007, but those discussions started to take place. We said we're going to have to take some other actions, and we did issue that proposal. Remember, it takes a while to actually get proposed rules out the door and approved. And those went out the door, I think, July 07, so we probably were working on those. Is that right? My time frame's right? I think I do. We probably must have started working on those late 06 or early 07.
I'm going to ask him about non-bank subs. Do you have any more on HUPA?
Just one. Well, same one I asked, same here. So do you remember any discussions at the time the first HMDA data came out, when all of a sudden you look at the HOPA flag and there don't seem to be so many of these things? Was this a question
of
like,
well, I do remember.
Oh, look, we've shut them down, or were they never there in the first place? You know, is the trigger still too high? I mean, that kind of question.
I do remember some discussion, because obviously we talked to our friend Glenn a lot.
And Bob.
Bob, that's your buddies. You know, I think, and I'm not an economist, so, you know, I don't remember a lot about it. I do remember somebody saying something to the effect that, you know, if people were trying to make these loans and avoid the risks of HOPA lending, the reputational risks of HOPA lending, the potential liabilities of HOPA lending, and the burdens of the compliance, you would expect there to be a huge amount of loans, or at least some bump up a number, just below that trigger. You'd say, look, all we have to do is just lower this a little bit, and we could. And I was told we didn't see that. We didn't see a whole bunch of these loans just below that threshold. So the answer is that market just doesn't exist for other reasons.
That's a good point. I'll go look it up.
That's all I recall.
I think the reporting on the 2004 data has the price breakdown, so I should be able to see how much is sitting in there at that time. Excellent. Thanks.
So now I want to ask slightly separately. Were you involved? Do you have knowledge of this sort of 1998 policy adoption, where the Fed said it's not going to examine non-bank subsidiaries of bank holding companies?
No, I wasn't involved in that at all. I'm a lawyer on the regulatory side. I don't know what sort of complaint. 98. In 98, I just become the manager, one of the managers in the regulatory area. That would have been a sort of a compliance oversight function, so no, I wouldn't have been involved in that.
Okay. In September 2009, the Fed reversed course, as I understand, after a year or two long pilot program.
We did a pilot program, correct.
And did you work on any of that?
No.
So none of that would have been coming across your desk. You wouldn't have knowledge of efforts to push the Fed to do more examinations of non-bank subsidiaries on consumer protection issues.
Well, I mean, I can't say you don't hear discussion. I can't say you don't have conversations with people. But it's not part of my responsibility.
So. What discussions did you have?
Oh, I was just aware that we were doing it. I mean, I'm certainly aware we had a pilot program. I'm certainly aware how they worked on that pilot program. And then for some time the question was, is, you know, what do we learn from the pilot, and what does that tell us going forward, and what are we going to do next? So I'm just aware it happened.
Were you aware of any efforts in 2001, 2002 led by Governor Gramlich to get the board to reverse that policy and to actually do examinations of non-bank subsidiaries.
And I know the first rule is you never shake your head when someone's tape recording. That's funny. Yes, I'm aware there were discussions going on at that time.
And who told you that that was going on?
I probably would have heard this from my boss at the time.
Who was?
Adrienne Hurt.
And what did she tell you?
I don't have any specific recollection. I can tell you what my impressions are now of what I think went on, but I can't tell you it's based on anything. I can't concretely say I had this conversation or that conversation.
That's okay. We're not bound by any legal rules here.
Isn't that convenient? My impression was that this was a very serious topic, given very serious consideration, and that people had different points of view. I know the compliance folks obviously had their point of view of what this meant in terms of our compliance program and the size of it and the resources involved. I know there's the policy, but it's considered also the policy of it in terms of, you know, the benefits. Governor Bramick was, you know, not a knee-jerk guy. He was a very thoughtful person. And I know there had to be some consideration. We know there was always a long-standing question, I think, and I can't attribute this to any particular place, time, or person, but there's always been this long-standing question of if, you know, as a regulator of bank holding companies, you have, under the Bank Holding Company Act, a certain amount of authority, jurisdiction, whatever, over the non-bank subs of those holding companies. Exactly where that line is run, I don't know. I'd let the general counsel worry about stuff like that. And that anytime you're dealing with something that can be both done within a bank holding company and outside a bank holding company by entities that are not banks, the question is it effective to regulate the practice only by some non-banks that are within holding company structures when you're not regulating that same practice and the whole rest of the world outside of the holding company structure? And if you do that, whether or not all you're doing is forcing those activities to migrate outside of the banking structure so that you have just as much of that activity, you just have it by different companies, and whether or not you've put your holding company in a non-competitive position or a disadvantage competitively, but you haven't affected the marketplace of what's going on. You just said you're not going to profit from, or whether or not you don't, you know, you're going to have any effect at all. I don't, that you know, I'm sure those kinds of things were discussions. Are we going to examine these institutions differently than the other institutions they compete with? Are we going to apply a different set of rules to them than the companies they have to compete with in the non-bank world? And there's always this question about the federal safety net, which is the role of the bank supervisors to worry about the institutions that are insured and subject to the bank safety net, or are we here to deal with the uninsured world and impose discipline on that? And the answer is, well, we don't have jurisdiction to impose it on half of it. We would only have discipline to authority to impose it on half. So, not my area of expertise, though.
Sure, sure. Thanks for sharing your recollections. Do you have?
Does the law apply? I mean, TILA and all the rest of these laws apply across the board, right?
It's just TILA applies
to
consumer
non bank sub, then the independent mortgage company has no examination. They're still subject to the same.
The non bank sub of a holding company, as a consumer lender, is subject to the same consumer credit regulations.
And even as an independent mortgage company outside of any holding company structure.
Correct.
The issue is really whether one actually does routine examination, transaction testing.
So to treat them equally, we're not going to examine any of them?
No, you can't. You can't. Well, there is no examination authority over the independents at all.
Right.
Even the FTC can't examine them. That's
what
they can't or they don't? I have no idea.
They can't. They don't have examiners. The FTC is an enforcement agency. They can bring an enforcement action, but they can't walk into a bank and say, we're here to examine your books and records, and if we don't like what you're doing, we're going to cease and desist. They can't do that.
So they
don't have safety and soundness authority.
They wait for a complaint. Is the only way they can sort of, somebody has to.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't want to characterize what the FTC does. But
I'll go read about it.
No, but they have investigative demand. I think they can make civil investigative demands. I don't know if they have to wait for complaints, but they don't have safety and soundness authority.
And they don't do regular compliance examinations.
No, I don't think they have any authority to do that.
Okay.
I'm good.
That's it for my end.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
End. This is the end.